Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. And for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Well, according to the New York Times and other sources, some on Robert Mueller's team say the report was more damaging than Barr's assessment revealed. Some of Robert Mueller's investigators have told associates that Attorney General William Barr failed to adequately portray the findings of their inquiry and that they were more troubling for President Trump than Mr. Barr indicated, according to government officials and others familiar with their simmering frustrations. What does this mean, and is this really true journalism to report such a story? Well, for insight into this, we turn to my first guest. He's a political analyst and host of the podcast Public Agenda, Ray Baker. Ray, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Dr. Leon, so glad to be here with you guys here on the Critical Hour at this very critical hour.
Thank you. So the New York Times and others are reporting, according to government officials and others familiar with the frustrations, they don't name names. Is this story concerning to you in any way, shape, or form?
Yeah, the entire layout of how that story was written and presented was dubious at best. And the reason why was because it had so much subjectivity. It starts with the idea or the premise that Mr. Mueller decided that Mr. Barr was best equipped to make decisions as to what was worth being prosecuted. It cited numerous government officials on background, and I completely understand that citing government officials on background is a way that many in the United States media operate. But at some point, with something so serious, somebody somewhere needs to start to put their name on something, and we did not see that in this report.
It says here, officials and others interviewed declined to flesh out why some of the special counsel's investigators viewed their findings as potentially more damaging for the president than Mr. Barr explained. That, to me, sounds almost as though people were standing by the water cooler saying, I can't believe that this thing came out. It's juvenile in many regards.
Juvenile is an interesting word choice there. One of the things I thought about when I read that particular passage that you're alluding to is, if something is more damaging, how is it more damaging?
Thank you.
Is it indeed the obstruction of justice that Mr. Mueller was searching for? If it's not, that's fine. We also saw in that same report that Mr. Mueller may have found other malfeasance. Okay, if you go searching for obstruction of justice and find bribery or something to that effect, then that's something the American public needs to know, something that Mr. Mueller could have created in the summary of information that he sent to Mr. Barr even prior to Mr. Barr's release of information. And so this continuous clandestine communication of it is something or it isn't, the American public needs to know if it is something, what is it, and then give us the opportunity to make that decision of if the something is a something.
One of the things that I have been trying to get people to understand as I've done interviews on these issues is there's a criminal investigation, and out of that criminal investigation could come felony indictments or other types of charges. That's on the criminal side. Then we have the impeachment side, and impeachment is not a criminal process. Impeachment is a political process. And so there may very well be in this report items that could move the House to file articles of impeachment, but that has nothing to do with criminal prosecution.
You're absolutely correct, Dr. Leon. And I think that, unfortunately, American media and sometimes even the American officials get so deeply entrenched in the political gamesmanship and the horse racing of who wins, who loses. Just yesterday, we saw an NBC reporter. I don't have the name correct, so I don't want to cite her without accurately speaking who it was. But she tweeted, will this pay off for Dems in the end, or will it look like they're just being sore losers? If this is a matter of national security and the question of the integrity of the American electoral system, what is a such thing as sore loser? That's an important question we're not answering. That's what we're not getting to when we need to get these points of unveiling and unraveling just what's going on here.
They also say in this story, it was unclear. I got to say here, too, it's important for people to understand this is the New York Times, which has been touted as what? The paper of record for the United States. So it was unclear how much discussion Mr. Mueller and his investigators had with senior Justice Department officials about how their findings would be made public. It was also unclear how widespread the vexation is among the special counsel team. So you're reporting that some on Mueller's team say report was more damaging, but you're unclear as to how widespread their vexation is? So what in the world are you telling me?
Correct. And also, they had such few details there, but such particular details on the tight relationship between Mr. Barr and Mr. Mueller. And so that leads me to conclude, if you have information, share with us that information. If you don't, this is not a story. Because many people in the United States can make their observations without doing the two-year Mueller report as to how they feel about the legitimacy of President Trump's collusion with Russian leaders. And the collusion question that most American media regularly ignores is, if there was indeed Russian interference, which everything that we have that we can verifiably trust suggests there was, the interference was not a hacking of voting machines. The interference was not voter intimidation or voter suppression. The interference was the same thing we saw nearly a century ago in United States-Russian relations, which is fanning the flames of American racism. So if we peel back a layer 2 or 3 degrees and see, wait, Russians found our scab and picked at it, perhaps we'd be more advantageous to fix that scab as opposed to yelling at who picked at our scab.
Well, I think it's also important in that conversation to point out that President Obama was very clear on this, that the intelligence reports on the issue of Russian involvement, the word is inconclusive. And so our mainstream media sources took those intelligence reports, seemed to have omitted the word inconclusive, and ran for 2 years with people telling us that the president is a Russian spy and that the president is guilty of treason and that he's going to be led out of the White House in handcuffs. The Mueller report doesn't seem to take us there, but mainstream media doesn't seem to want to let it go.
The Mueller report, we can't say with any certainty what the Mueller report says.
We haven't seen it.
Because we haven't seen it, and we know at the least there is debate internally, a small debate, medium debate or large debate internally about whether or not the representation of it that we got from Mr. Barr was indeed accurate.
And here's the final point. I know your time is very limited and I'll let you go. Mr. Barr and other Justice Department officials believe the special counsel's investigation fell short of their task by declining to decide whether Trump illegally obstructed the inquiry. Okay. So then after Mueller made no judgment, Barr stepped in to declare that he himself had cleared Trump of wrongdoing. So now they seem to be angry that Mueller did not find him guilty of obstruction. Barr looked at it and found no obstruction, but they're now still angry. Who are they angry at and what are they angry about? It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, it seems as though they were angry with Mr. Mueller being unwilling to put his finger on the scale. If that is indeed their point of contention, that's reasonable and fine to both come to the media and take it up with Mr. Mueller. If they're also mad at Mr. Barr for then putting his finger on the scale in place of Mr. Mueller, then there needs to be clarity in what that is. Now, I'm not certain if the lack of clarity comes from the anonymous sources, because, again, they're anonymous sources. We as other interviewers, journalists ourselves, or a learned public can't go and do follow-up with those folks because they're on background. Or if the lack of clarity is from the writers from the New York Times, who in other situations and around other stories we found to do much more diligent reporting. So we're curious as to what's going on here, where the lack of clarity is, because with that clarity, we'll have the answer to your question, Dr. Leon.
Ray Baker, as always, man, thank you so much for your contribution to the Critical Hour. Look forward to having you back.
Yes, sir. I'm appreciative to be invited each and every time.
Thanks, man. All right, folks, you're listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Reparations bill wins new momentum in Congress. House legislation to form a commission to study whether African Americans should receive reparations for slavery is getting a significant boost from Democrats on the presidential campaign trail. Representative Karen Bass, Democrat from California and the head of the Congressional Black Caucus, suggested that action on a reparations measure sponsored by Representative Sheila Jackson Lee, Democrat from Texas, is all but certain, with Democrats now in control of the lower chamber and the idea gaining prominence on the national stage. What does this mean for the movement going forward, and does it say anything about a change in the American perspective on the issue? Well, for insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He's a research professor and director of the Institute for Urban Research at Morgan State University, and he's the author of numerous articles and has published three books, The Warrior Method, A Parent's Guide to Rearing Healthy Black Boys, Should America Pay?, as well as Raging Debate on Reparations and Melinda's Petition. He is Professor Raymond Winbush. Professor Winbush, welcome to the Critical Hour.
How you doing, brother?
I'm doing well, sir. Thank you so much for joining us today. So let's start with the news. We know that Congressman John Conyers had been on this quest for over 25 years. So what does it say to you now, or does it say anything to you now, that Representative Karen Bass is saying that she's going to move on Representative Jackson Lee's measure?
Well, it's an achievement. It's not a victory, but it's an achievement. As you just stated, since 1989, former Congressman John Conyers had introduced a bill not for reparations, but just to study the impact of enslavement on Black America as well as white America. It was just to do a study on it. And it's been stuck in Congress since that time. And I'm glad now that it's moving right along, which is what we've always wanted. And it's going to come to a vote.
And once it comes to a vote and it is assumed that it will pass, what happens after that?
Well, after that, a commission is established to study the impact on enslavement in the United States. And this precedes all forms of reparations. The Japanese did it in the late 70s, in fact. Native American groups have done it. It's just a procedural issue. The commission then determines what impact enslavement had. And clearly, this is a huge study. The one fortunate thing in the delay since 1989, there's been several research articles, books, pamphlets, and just a tremendous amount of research in the past 20 years about the impact of enslavement. And it has numbers attached to it. I can think of Richard America there at Georgetown University, who's done a very comprehensive study about how much America owes the descendants of enslaved Africans.
Edward Baptist's book, The Half Has Never Been Told, is a phenomenal study on the economics of slavery. And then also you have Slavery by Another Name, which doesn't necessarily deal with slavery, but it deals with Jim Crow and the convict leasing system.
Convict labor system, exactly. So all of these studies I'm sure that many of the people who have written these books, articles, you know, and published on this stuff will be before that commission. And that's the purpose of it, is to see, I mean, how much, you know, economic impact did enslavement have on Africans in America? And, I mean, if you look at Richard America's work, he estimates between $8 to $10 trillion And I mean, that's a lot of money, but it's a point at which you can start framing how reparations would be paid.
One of the things that came out of Edward Baptist's book is he drew a comparison of the cotton industry during that time, and he compared it. He said America was to the international cotton industry what Saudi Arabia is to the oil industry.
And that's a perfect analogy.
And yeah, exactly. I'm glad you brought up the other point that you did, because I want you to talk about this in the political context. Well, this whole there was a time, say back in the 80s, and when Dr. Ronald Walters and others were championing the cause, and there was a lot of public discussion, but short of the congressman, I just mentioned his name, from Detroit.
Conyers.
Short of Conyers' action, there was very little legislative action. Now we seem to have more legislative action in front of the public discussion. Do you see a change in the dynamic there?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that because groups like NCOBRA, the National Coalition of Blacks for Reparations in America, NBUF, National Black United Front, we have been pushing this on a national and international level for many, many years. The oldest political discussion among black people, not only in this country, but throughout the world, is on the issue of reparation or repairing the damage done to African people for the past 500 years. So these discussions, now that they've risen to the top, not joked about, but actually risen to the top, it's a good discussion. It will also look at what America is all about, not only black folk, but white people too. And as Ta-Nehisi Coates says in a recent article about reparation, the idea of it being joked about is like over with. It's a serious discussion right now, and I'm glad to see it.
And one of the things that I've talked about for a number of years is one of the problems that I see with the discussion is people that are against the idea of reparations or don't really understand what reparations is about, they try to dismiss the conversation by moving to what they consider to be the practicality or the impracticality of reparations. Oh, so what are you going to do? Give everybody $100? Or what are you going to do? And I've always said, well, you're putting the cart before the horse, because before we can even talk about what form reparations should actually take, we first have to answer the question of, are they owed?
Well, exactly. And that's what the purpose of H.R. 40 is. That's going to be the purpose of the commission itself. But you know something, Wilmer? Every time black folk are about to do something that white America perceives as being too radical or impractical, things, you know, small things like the freeing of Africans during after the Civil War or Brown v. Board, there's always this canard thrown out. What are going to be the consequences of it? This is going to bankrupt America. What are all these 4 million people who have been freed from enslavement going to do? And see, it's always been proven wrong. And the same thing about reparations. Reparations can take a variety of forms, just like Brown v. Board in 1954 ultimately led to the Voting Rights Act, open housing, affirmative action, a variety of things. Reparations can take a variety of forms, not just a check in the mail, scholarship, tax relief, land reclamation, and a variety of other things. So, you know, if you're a student of history, and I know you are, we know that this is the reaction all the time of white America to something that they consider as being too radical in the black community.
One of the things that I think gets overlooked is, what does reparations mean? And so I always start, let's be sure that we understand the word. And so the definition of reparation is the making of amends for a wrong one has done by paying money to or otherwise helping those who have been wronged. And one of the key operative words in that statement is amends. And what amends means is to correct the harm. And I go through that because there are those who would say, oh, well, you got the Voting Rights Act. Oh, you got the Fair Housing Act. Oh, you got all this legislation. But what gets overlooked is the harm has never been corrected.
It has never been corrected. It has never even been addressed. You know, and I'm not trying to name drop, but Archbishop Tutu is a very good friend of mine. His daughter, in fact, when I taught at Fisk University, worked for me. And the thing about it, like Bishop Tutu, we call him Bra Arch, he used to say, the trouble with you Americans is that you have never reconciled yourself to what happened during the 250-some-odd years of enslavement and the 100 years of American apartheid. South Africa, in one sense, has made more of a racial reconciliation advance than the United States, and they did it in 30 years, and they're not perfect, don't get me wrong, but we have never addressed it. There was an attempt during the Clinton administration, which failed, about a so-called national dialogue on race. This country has never come to grips with what being an American is, what America did relative to enslavement. And until it does, it will never live up to the words in, the Star Spangled Banner, the Constitution, Declaration of Independence. It will never be the America that it claims to be but isn't.
That's a very important point because a lot of people look at this conversation as though it's just for the descendants of enslaved Africans. But America can never truly be anything close to what it proclaims to be or through its documents professes to be if it doesn't come to grips with this issue. And the whole process of studying the issue empirically, studying the issue and coming to a determination. Because, for example, Congress did issue a resolution apologizing for slavery. That was about, 10, 15 years ago, maybe a little longer. But that was conditional. The condition was this cannot be used as a rationale for reparations. So a conditional apology is not an apology.
It isn't. If I break the windows of your car, as I said recently in an article, and I look at the car and say, it's a shame those windows got broken. And you know I broke it. And I said, I'm sorry I broke it, but if I apologize to you, I don't want you to come at me to make me repair those windows. Well, it's an empty apology. And that's how I looked at, the Senate resolution that was passed. And many state legislatures, unfortunately, kind of walked those things through the same way. And they were empty apologies, very hollow.
And I go back to the point about America being what America is supposed to be, because what people listening to this need to ask themselves is what will be the international response, the international perception to America if America actually comes to grips with and addresses its ugly, vile past?
I think it would be, and this is one of the reasons why I'm in opposition to, ADOS, this group that's talking about we got to take care of our stuff at all. Look, Australia did a national sorry day 20-something years ago, apologized publicly, and then started making restitution, which they're still to the Aboriginal people, one of the most mistreated people on earth. People welcome that, not only nationally, but internationally. There's examples of national apologies leading to reparations throughout the world. The Maori people, for example. So, I think it would show, it would say to the world, America really is America. It really lives by these precepts. Now, we have people in office now who clearly are in opposition to anything that even remotely resembles America apologizing for its past and making restitution to his people, even though this country has done it with the Japanese, with certain indigenous groups in this country. So America has a path to do it. It's just that the biggest debt, as Randall Robinson says, is the debt owed from enslavement.
Professor Raymond Winbush, research professor and director of the Institute for Urban Research at Morgan State University. Thank you so much for your time today. Thank you for your contribution to the Critical Hour, and look forward to having you back.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, folks, you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Hundreds of millions of Facebook records are exposed on Amazon cloud servers. A vast collection of data on Facebook users was exposed to the public until recently on Amazon's cloud computing servers, researchers have found. Two third-party Facebook app developers were found to have stored user data on Amazon servers in a way that allowed it to be downloaded by the public, according to a report from UpGuard, a cybersecurity firm. How big of a problem is this? And we continue to seem to be having these conversations, and we're peeling back this onion. Well, for insight into this and other issues, we turn to my next guest. He's a web developer and technologist, Chris Garaffa. Chris, as always, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Oh, thank you for having me back on. I'm sorry it's always in situations like this.
So help me understand here, is the headline overdoing it? Millions of Facebook records found on Amazon cloud servers. How big of a problem is this?
No, there really isn't a way to overstate how bad this is. And it's really important, too, to understand who's involved in this. So this is information about Facebook users. We're talking of, you know, hundreds of millions, 540 million, they say, talking about what people liked, their comments, how they reacted, tying all of that to their Facebook name and, you know, and their Facebook ID. And that was just available on the internet, open for anyone who could find it, and it's not, you know, super difficult to find these things if you're looking for them, to go find and download. And so that's the first one.
Wait a minute. To that point, I'm glad you brought that up because that was my next question. How would I know to do this? How would I know to go to Amazon in search of this Facebook data?
Well, we should, you know, be clear here that this data was not actually in Facebook's control in this archive.
Right.
But it's data that Facebook gave another company through its APIs. The API is the way that somebody writes an application for Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
So this third-party group, Cultura Colectiva, based out of Mexico, wrote applications and collected all this information and just left it out on the internet. So first, Facebook gave them access to this information, and then Cultura Colectiva just left it out, you know, in this archive open on the internet. So there's no way to just sign up and search around and say, hey, is my information out there somewhere? But security researchers, as well as malicious actors, are often searching public Amazon storage for these types of things.
And okay.
We should say, this is not the part of Amazon where you go and buy stuff. This is an entirely different Amazon, their web services division.
So as we continue to have conversations about privacy, about the protection of data, the fact that these were web developers, Facebook gave these third-party web developers access to this data, my simplistic mind says that Facebook was not implementing the proper control sets to be sure that the data was protected. Is that too simplistic to say?
Not at all. You know, this is related also to that Cambridge Analytica scandal from a little while ago, because in the past, Facebook gave companies a lot more access to your information than they do today. They have cracked down on what they will give access to for the most part. So I don't believe that today you could write an application that would get all of this information, at least not very easily. And certainly, you know, people would have to interact with those applications. But, you know, when you go and interact with an app, you're not thinking about what information it's getting. You're thinking about the result you're getting from it, right? The interactions you're having with friends or games or whatnot. So, I, you know, it might not be possible today for this application to be written, but Facebook certainly has in the past been more than happy to give out anything that these apps wanted about us without, you know, without any regard to what it would mean. That was part of their business model.
So it says that one of the articles that I read said that the database was closed yesterday after Bloomberg alerted Facebook to the problem and Facebook contacted Amazon. Is the horse already out of the barn at this point?
Well, we would need to find out from Amazon, if they will ever announce it, who downloaded this database. Did anyone else have access to this database or find it, you know, and grab it before they took it down? UpGuard, you know, did the right thing. They notified Cultura Collectiva when they got no responses. And they did this. They started this months ago in January, by the way. And they've got no response. They notified Amazon and got no response until, like you said, Bloomberg got involved and messaged them. So Amazon would have to say, who accessed this and where were they coming from and how many times was it accessed for us to know who could have this information.
The Bloomberg article says that Facebook shared this kind of information freely with third-party developers for years before cracking down more recently. How important is the data that was shared to developing an application versus how important is the data that was shared as a revenue generator because of the nature of the data? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, really, the only reason you'd really want to keep this data is to sell ads and to sell targeted advertisements. And to do, you know, analysis on how people feel about different things, right? So it is possible in just to have a computer scan a conversation between two or more people about a specific topic and figure out how they feel about it by looking at the words and the emojis and the, you know, all of that that they put into that conversation. So then you can figure out, all right, these people like this certain thing. So we're going to sell, you know, we're going to sell them ads or show them ads for things that are similar to that item or for that item itself. And that item could be, you know, electronics, it could be books, TV shows, subscription services, whatever it is. That's really the only reason you need to keep 140-something gigabytes of data on people around.
The Bloomberg article also says that, quote, the public doesn't realize yet that these high-level systems administrators and developers, the people that are custodians of this data, they are being either risky or lazy or cutting corners. That makes me wonder, and the analogy I'll use is if you're a gun owner, you can't leave your unlocked loaded pistol on the kitchen table for children to come across and play with. They call it an attractive nuisance. We always seem to be dealing with these issues after the fact. How concerned should we be that the custodians of this data still seem to be engaged in risky practices as it comes down to some of our most personal and important information?
Yeah, I mean, people need to start paying massive fines and going to jail. If you leave a gun out on the table, you are negligent. You're not just being risky, but you are being absolutely negligent. It's the same with this. There is absolutely no reason that Cultura Collectiva should have had this information available. There is no reason Amazon should have ignored the reports for months. And there's no reason that Facebook should have been allowing them to have this information in the first place. People need to go to jail for stuff like this because these things can lead, in the extreme circumstances, to identity theft or impersonation or stalking or worse. And that's very, very dangerous. In terms of, you know, what people need to know is that we only find out, we only know what we know, right? We don't know what the next one is going to be. And that's part of the main problem here, is that there needs to be oversight ahead of time. There need to be third-party independent audits of all of these social, you know, digital services and social networks in order to identify what their practices are and what risks they're putting us at.
Final question to you. So Zuckerberg goes before Congress. I'm not going to say he fell on the sword. I'll just say he knelt very close to the sword. To your point about going to prison or being held accountable, he did some mea culpas and we're gonna do better in the future. Are you getting any sense that there are actual policies, best practices being put in place to prevent this? So are we still dealing with the wake of the initial problem, or is the problem just continuing to get larger?
No, there are no real good solutions out there right now to address any of this. I will say Senator Ron Wyden has introduced some legislation. I doubt it's going to get anywhere, but I appreciate that he's done it. But he compares it to Sarbanes-Oxley, which, if you remember, after the MCI WorldCom and Enron issues, was supposed to protect, the financial, target the financial industry for fraud and all of that. And he compared it to that. But the problem is almost no one has gone to jail under Sarbanes-Oxley. And so I can't see anyone, even if his law did pass, can't see Mark Zuckerberg putting on a pinstripe suit, putting on the stripes and marching into a federal prison. And that's what we need. We need executives to know that ultimately they are on the line for this. And it is up to them to make sure that security is being taken care of and funded properly.
Chris Garaffa, as always, thank you so much for your time. As always, thank you for your contribution to the Critical Hour. Look forward to having you back. All right, folks, you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Trump administration is spending enormous resources to strip citizenship from a Florida truck driver. Well, what does this mean for Mr. Parvez Manzoor Khan, a 62-year-old Floridian? What does it mean for his family? And what does it mean for those in similar circumstances? Well, for insight into this, we turn to my next guest. She writes and teaches in the fields of constitutional law, immigration and citizenship law, federal courts and jurisdiction, and judicial ethics at American University. She is Professor Amanda Frost. Professor Frost, welcome to the Critical Hour.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So this story I took out of The Intercept, and let me just read the opening paragraph. With almost no one watching, the federal government on Tuesday went to trial in one of the first denaturalization cases of the Trump era, a project the administration enthusiastically rolled out in 2017. Let's start with the generic or more general conversation about denaturalization. What does this mean? And do you see this as a problem?
Sure. And I'll just say it's true. Almost no one was watching. I was one of the people there. There were four people there, that journalist, myself, and two government attorneys in the audience. So really, no one from the public except for the journalist and I were paying attention, which is too bad. So denaturalization is the process by which someone who gained citizenship, not at birth through a birthright citizenship, such as being born in the United States, but rather someone who had a different citizenship and acquired U.S. citizenship later. That's called naturalization. That's how people become U.S. citizens who aren't born U.S. citizens. Denaturalization is when those people are told, no, you never should have been given that citizenship in the first place, and we are taking it away.
In fact, I'm glad you mentioned birthright citizenship, because there have been discussions of late about even changing the birthright citizenship constitutional provision, correct?
Correct. And actually, this is a subject very near and dear to my heart. I'm writing a book called Unmaking Americans, where I talk about citizenship stripping broadly. So not just denaturalization, which I think should concern all of us, but also the efforts, not just by this administration, but by the American government throughout history to deny people citizenship. So we have, of course, the horrific example of the Dred Scott decision, in which the Supreme Court said No African-American freer slave was to be considered a citizen. That was back in 1857. Since then, we've had citizenship denied for Chinese-Americans, people born in the United States of Chinese ancestry. The government argued should not get citizenship back in 1898. They lost that case. They've done it again and again. Women who married birthright citizens, women who were born in the U.S., who married non-citizens, were told they'd lost their citizenship between 1907 and about 1930. So this is not brand new, but I would argue the Trump administration's bringing it back after a long period when we weren't seeing it being done.
There have been a number of reports, people coming from Latin America, pregnant to give birth to a child on American shores. There were stories and recent reports of Chinese nationals coming to the United States. There are, I think, even travel agencies in China that assist Chinese nationals to come to the United States so that the wife can give birth. They make this out as though it's a huge, huge problem. Do you have any idea? Is this a drop in the bucket? I mean, is this really much ado about nothing?
Yeah, that's pretty tiny. That's birth tourism, people call it. I mean, obviously, you have to have enormous amounts of resources if you're Chinese, you're planning to keep living in China, but you come to the U.S. just to have a child in the U.S. I think that's a pretty rare situation. You know, the question about immigrants from South America, Central America, coming to the U.S., whether seeking asylum, coming in legally or coming in illegally, you know, those are people that we are obviously having a huge national conversation about. And I think the question of what happens to their children is just part of that bigger conversation. It's not really a separate problem. And I don't think the desperate people coming across our border are doing so specifically to have children here. They're doing so to make a better life for themselves and often for their already born children who are not U.S. citizens, of course.
So let's go back to Mr. Parvez Manzoor Khan, a 62-year-old grandfather. I believe he received his naturalization about 20 years ago. Talk about his case and why you went to hear this case.
Yeah, so I was interested in this case because he was one of three people that the government touted in a press release as being the first three targets of a new program to ramp up denaturalization, to start denaturalizing more people. It's called Operation Janus and Operation Second Look. Those are the government's names for this program. And I should add, it was started by the Obama administration, but on a much narrower and more constrained basis. And I should also add, I think there was some reasons for the government to be concerned. It turned out that there was a group of fingerprints that had been taken from people but not uploaded into a database. So it was a government error, a government glitch. And because those fingerprints hadn't been uploaded into a database, when some of those people went to become citizens, you couldn't check to see whether they'd had an immigration status problem in the past. So I think the government rightly said, we need to look into this. We need to make sure that there aren't people who became citizens who we really never should have made citizens, either because they pose a national security risk or they had some, you know, clear problem in their past that meant they're really bad for this country to have here permanently. And what the Obama administration said is, all right, we've identified that problem. We're going to look into these people, but we're not going to look to strip people of their citizenship they may have had now for decades, unless there's really a concern, such as they're truly bad actors or perhaps they pose a national security risk. We'll go after those people. We're not going to try to strip someone of citizenship because, for example, there was a typo or some other small error in their naturalization file. So that was the Obama policy's, Obama administration's approach. But when the Trump administration took office, they very clearly ramped up this program. They've said in press releases they're now going to be investigating 700,000 naturalization files. That is, I don't know where they get the number, but it is far beyond the number of fingerprints that weren't uploaded, which had been about 300,000. And they've also said they've opened a new office in Los Angeles and asked for tens of millions of dollars, which is an enormous amount of money to spend. So I was interested in Parvez Manzoor Khan's case because I thought, huh.
Wait a minute. Let me just quickly say in what I'm reading, in a budget request for the 2019 fiscal year, they asked for $208 million to investigate 887 additional leads it expects to get into American citizens who may be vulnerable to denaturalization and to review another 700,000 files.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So that's That shows you, and I looked at that budget, and actually the $200 million figure covers a few other things beyond denaturalization, so okay. I don't want to say all of that money's going to that, but okay. yes, they listed it as one of the things they would spend the money on and a significant part of what they would spend the money on. So we're just talking, you know, just as a taxpayer, I think people should be questioning this, even if right. you have no sympathy at all for longtime citizens who are now having their status questioned, which brings us to who is Mr. Khan? You know, is he someone who poses a national security risk? Is he a truly bad actor, like one of these former Nazi prison guards that gets discovered and then we decide we want to denaturalize them because we never would have given them citizenship if we'd known about the atrocities they committed? That's one example of the kind of person who gets denaturalized. So, you know, I went to Mr. Khan's trial. I heard the government, read the government's briefs. I've seen the testimony. He has no criminal convictions. He's 62 years old. He's a truck driver. He's always paid his taxes. He's married to a U.S. citizen. He's been in the United States 27 years. He's been a citizen for over a decade. He is a U.S. citizen son. Did he do something wrong? Yes, he did. When he first came into this country, he used a false passport. That was in 1991. And he was immediately discovered and detained. He didn't speak English. And when he was released, he mistakenly thought, well, I'm free to go. They've told me I'm free to go. I'm released. This means it's all over and done with. And the government never followed up. They sent some notices to his attorney, who never sent them on to him. The government never asked him directly about any issues with his entrance to the United States. It was a mistake. He assumed the government knew about it and had no problem with it and went ahead and gave him citizenship. Now, the government argues that he lied and knew that the government didn't know about his entry and nonetheless tried to get citizenship and lied about it. That's very much contested, and we'll see what the judge says.
What is contested? That is a fact, or that is a mitigating circumstance?
Oh, so what's contested is the fact of, did he lie to the government while he was being given his citizenship? So he applied for a green card, and then he got it, and he applied for citizenship, and he got it. And the government says, well, you lied. You purposely hid the fact that you came into the U.S. under a different name with a different passport. And he says, no, I didn't. No one asked me that question. I told them everything about me now, which is my current, you know, my official name. I never lied. I thought the government knew how I came in. He remembered the government holding him and taking his fingerprints. He thought it was all clear. So that's one question. Did he lie? I should add here, because I think it's important and your listeners might not realize this, even coming in under a false passport, which is obviously illegal, he shouldn't have done it, that wouldn't have blocked him from getting citizenship necessarily. He could still have qualified for asylum. No, he could have still qualified for asylum. It could be something that the government says, all right, we consider that, but we're willing to give you citizenship anyway. That is not in and of itself an automatic denial of a citizenship. What would be grounds for denaturalization is if he lied in the naturalization process. And that's what the government said he did. And he says, no, I didn't lie. I didn't volunteer how I entered, but I thought you knew it. And I didn't understand the process when I entered or why I was released. And that's for the judge to decide.
Well, two things. One, the government did know because the government sent notices to his attorney. So the government did know, provided he's used the same name in the original entry and the name he's using now.
So he did. He's used it was a different name, and the government officials did not know when they granted him his citizenship about the way he entered because they didn't have his fingerprints. And again, that was an error on the government's part for not uploading the fingerprints.
Okay. So now I think you said this, but help me go through this just a little slower. When he applied for citizenship, is there a question? Is there a box to check? Is there anything that goes to his previous history, or is he correct in saying you did not ask me this question? As in, ask me no questions, I'll tell you no lies.
Yes. So that is a very debatable question that, as I said, the judge seemed very interested in that at the trial. The questions on the citizenship form do ask about other names used and about the means by which someone entered the U.S. or whether they'd ever lied to get an immigration benefit. He was not a native English speaker, filling out these forms without a lawyer's help. And he says, I answered to the best of my ability and didn't try to lie or mislead anybody. And the government says he did. And so that's the open question. Some of those questions are quite vaguely worded and could be confusing to a non-English speaker. or perhaps he was lying. That's for the judge to decide.
How much of this, as an attorney and as a immigration attorney and as a constitutional attorney, how much of this do you see as being truly a substantive problem versus a political solution looking for a problem? And is that a relevant question?
Yes, I think it is. And I go back to my point about the taxpayer. In part, I think that's what the concern is for me, along with some other concerns. The idea that government is spending all this money to pursue somebody like Mr. Khan is disturbing because, frankly, he doesn't pose any sort of a risk or hazard based on his very long record in this country. He works. He pays taxes. He has no criminal problems. He doesn't work in national security. It's not that I think he behaved perfectly in our immigration process. He didn't. But is this who I want the government to spend millions and millions of dollars pursuing? No. There's a lot of things I'd like the government to do first to keep me safe. The other problem, and this goes to your point about the politics, there is a sense from these cases and from the denaturalization campaign and from the Trump administration's approach to immigration generally that the real goal here is to make America an unwelcoming place for immigrants. And every time that a person who's received naturalization, who's received their citizenship through that process, hears about this denaturalization campaign, about the investigations, about the scope of them, they have to start fearing, maybe there was a flaw or an error in my naturalization process. Maybe I'm at risk. And in fact, at the trial, the government began attacking Mr. Khan's brother's naturalization. This was not an issue at the trial. He was a witness, and the government said, well, we're going to question him about it. We think it goes to his credibility. And I think that shows you just how vulnerable naturalized citizens have become in this climate and how much America is making it clear to immigrants, we don't want you, even if you think you're doing everything possible to be legally present here. You are always at risk of having your status removed.
There's a quote here, a segment here I'd like to read from the Intercept piece. A government victory in Khan's case would likely embolden the Trump administration to expand its denaturalization efforts, which it seems poised to do. In a January 2018 press release, the Justice Department wrote that U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services has stated its intention to refer approximately an additional 1,600 for prosecution. This pretty much is, I'm going to ask the question I just asked, having read this, as an expert in this area, how concerned are you? And again, this started in the Obama administration, but it now seems to be on steroids in the Trump administration.
Yes, and that's true of a lot of immigration initiatives that were started small and in a constrained fashion under President Obama and have been expanded as broadly as they can be under President Trump. And I think that is, if you look at who was in the Trump administration, people like Jeff Sessions, who were in charge of this expansion before he left as Attorney General, these are people who are opposed to immigration, not just undocumented or illegal immigration, but all immigration. They don't want legal immigrants coming. They're opposed to that part of our immigration system. So when we see that is the background of these officials, and then when we see them urging Department of Justice attorneys to bring these cases, I think we can say, look, there's more than just an agenda here to take away citizenship from a few bad actors or from some people that pose a national security risk. That was what the Obama administration did, and Republican administrations before Obama as well were very constrained in their use of denaturalization. What this administration is doing is saying we want people that are immigrants to feel at risk. And they're giving that message by investigating hundreds of thousands of naturalized citizens. Masha Gessen, who's a naturalized citizen and a reporter for The New Yorker and someone who writes about these issues, she said this has taken away her assumption of permanence. She assumed she could stay, that she could write articles that were critical of the government and not fear for her status as a U.S. citizen. And now she has to wonder, am I one of the people they're looking at to see whether there's some glitch in my application? And I should add here, as an immigration lawyer, as well as a professor, I can tell you that the process for getting a green card and then citizenship is complicated enough with enough open-ended, broad questions that I think anyone who applies for citizenship under that process, you could find some glitch, some error in their application. And under the denaturalization statute, that's very broadly worded with no statute of limitations, that person's naturalization could be attacked decades later.
My final question to you, listening to the campaign rhetoric about Mexicans being rapists and drug dealers and all of that, understanding the Muslim ban and the intention behind the Muslim ban, looking at the fact that the targets, two of whom of this operation are from Pakistan, I believe another one is from Bangladesh. I don't hear President Trump screaming about au pairs from Ireland living in Boston.
Yeah.
So, yes. So am I, as an African American, I'm very much in tune to this rhetoric. So am I wrong to see a bias here?
No, not at all. And in fact, sort of embedded in this denaturalization program is the administration says we're going after people from countries of quote unquote special interest. Well, those are people from countries that are predominantly Muslim. As you point out, the race, religion, ethnicity plays a role here, and it always has. If you look at the history of citizenship stripping in the United States, race has played a very prominent, you know, very sad, unfortunate, and, you know, in some ways consistent with a lot of other problems we have in our country, a very prominent role. And here it is playing that same role again.
Professor Amanda Frost, thank you so much for your time. Greatly appreciate your contribution to the Critical Hour and really look forward to having you back. I enjoyed this conversation. Thank you.
Me too. Thank you very much.
All right.
Bye.
All right, folks, you have been listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you all for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.